Minneapolis on November 25, 2007. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning, everybody. It's good to see you all. In Plato's account of the death of Socrates, I believe, there's this famous observation made by Socrates: an unexamined life is not worth living. Perhaps you've heard that. It's a pretty well-known phrase. The unexamined life is not worth living. Socrates probably was talking about certainly looking at your life, but maybe testing different ideas about it. Maybe in an effort to come to some kind of understanding, some kind of conceptual view, an idea, a model of how one should live. Perhaps this is what he was doing. I don't know. How wise was Socrates? According to the oracle at Delphi, Socrates was the wisest of all men. It was just Greeks or the wisest of all men, I think it was. And why? Well, it's because he knew that he did not know. Socrates, always wandering around Athens, annoying everybody by questioning everything that they thought or believed. Whatever philosophical theory or stance someone would take, and Socrates would come in there and question it. Always questioning. And he himself never settled on anything. But what did he understand in that regard? Well, I don't know, and I'm certainly not going to guess. Socrates, certainly a great man, one that I admire. But an interesting question there. But he said about this questioning and looking, to examine one's life. Look at this. Don't just take everything as just kind of a package deal. This is what you've been handed. This is what other people think. This is what you yourself think, that you frame this up now for yourself, but to continuously examine this. And I don't know that we don't have it recorded. He himself didn't write anything down, but it was never recorded that he got to the point of actually stating that whatever you do get in your hands, it isn't something that ultimately we can rely on. Doesn't seem like he ever put that anywhere, but always questioning. And maybe that's best, really, rather than finally to come out and making such a dogmatic statement as that. So indeed, a very wise man. I want to take a look at this from the standpoint of the awakened. What does the Buddha Dharma teach, the teaching of the awakened? Do they say anything about this? We have it in Dogen. Dogen's Genjo Koan, Dogen's Genjo Koan, realization of ultimate reality. Dogen says, again, a very famous line out of that piece, where he says, to study the way is to study the self. You know, examine life. To examine the self, Socrates says, otherwise the life is not worth living. Dogen points out that to study the way is to study the self. To study the way, what is he referring to there? Of course, this is the way of awakening, the way of the Buddhas. Those who are awake, their way that they make it through this world. And that is just simply in being awake, not being deceived. As perhaps maybe Socrates, not being deceived because he always came back with a question. So examining life in this way, well, Dogen says that to study the way of enlightenment is to study the self, he says. And then he goes on to say that to study the self is to forget the self. Why would he say that? Well, it's because if we get hold of some ideas about self, inevitably, we're going to run into a contradiction. We run into trouble there. If we take hold of something, a Socrates could always come along and question that, or a Nagarjuna, as we have in our tradition. And inevitably, as Nagarjuna shows us in no uncertain terms, it's defeated. It's, you know, whatever you want to put there, that is not it. And of course, this self, this little self that I am, you know, that you, for each one of us, are this ego that we all know so well, or do we? But this sense that we have of me, of I, that we base everything on and act out of, well, whatever idea we have there, whatever, if we examine this, if we test this, if we look at this carefully, what do you mean by that? What do you think you've gotten hold of there? We will find that, well, we don't really seem to have gotten hold of anything. This is why Dogen then goes on to say that to study this way is to study, the way of enlightenment is to study the self. To study the self, take a very careful look at this ego, this me, this I, this entity here that we think is. We don't find this. So to study the way of enlightenment is to study this, look at that, and in looking at this and studying this, he says ultimately, is to forget it. To let it go. Don't even, at some point we can stop even trying to figure it out. There's nothing there to figure out. Or whatever gets figured out is just something that gets nailed down, solidified, and identified, and labeled, and always vulnerable to a Socrates or a Nagarjuna who can come along and just shred it for us. Of course, then we get annoyed with one like that, and then like in the case of Socrates, they put him to death finally. Just had enough of this sort of thing, corrupting the minds of the youth of Athens. So Dogen just comes right out with it, and he just says, ultimately we come to this place where we, well, forget it. Because we can come to some understanding, some realization, you know, that we're not going to get hold of anything. But this is telling us something rather significant about life here, our reality, our life, and what it is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. Because in whatever it is that we're taking hold of here, it's delusional, as we've looked at in many other classes and talks that I've given. I won't take time with that now, but it's delusional. And, or, well, it's illusory, and the delusion comes with our taking hold of it as if it were true, real, substantial. There's the delusion. So we just set that aside. This is now to study, truly study the self. What is this self exactly? Well, this is actually, it's the self has to be what does not change. That is what we can never get hold of, because anything we take hold of is fleeting. Genjokon means the realization, the awareness of ultimate reality. That's what he's talking about. But it doesn't have any selfhood about any fixedness, any substantial thing that we can get hold of here. But nevertheless, here it is, the reality, continuously unfolding. And it is always like this, and we can never get hold of it. So if we want to study that, if we want to awaken to that, then he's saying, then we set aside our ideas that we have about this self. We examine this very carefully, as Socrates recommended, and we notice that we can't, you know, and this will reveal something about actual reality. And then we set this aside. Well, there's another interesting way of looking at this. It comes from the Mumon Khan, the 39th case of the Mumon Khan, collection of Zen koans. Story of Yunmen, or Umen, Yunmen greets him. One of my favorites is this guy doesn't say much, but it's always very pithy stuff. Really gets right to the very heart of things. So here we have Yunmen, his Chinese name. Yunmen sitting there, and a student comes in. And a student says something like, the brilliance of the Buddhas illumines the whole universe. Yunmen just cuts him off and says, you're reciting another's verse. And the student said, yes. And Yunmen says, you're sidetracked. Then at the end we have Muman's comment. If you understand this place where he's sidetracked, if you see that place, he said, then you are a teacher of gods and men, something like that. And he says, if you do not understand this, then you don't even understand your own mind. You don't understand yourself. You haven't examined this. You haven't looked at this. You do not understand. Because if you did, you would know that place where we become sidetracked. Well, that's that story that we find in Muman Khan. And it's really quite interesting. There's a lot there. There's a lot to be said about that spot, that place. And in fact, that would be just a whole talk right there in itself. It makes me think of yet again another way of looking at all of this, and from, of all people, Vladimir Horowitz. You know, Vladimir Horowitz, the great pianist. This is what he had to say about, just talking about pianos, the name is. Here he's talking about teaching and about artistry and playing and performing and knowing oneself, perhaps we could say. But truly, truly knowing the self, not this little self. Though Horowitz himself, I suspect, probably had a pretty big ego. But when it came to the piano and playing the piano, have you ever seen Horowitz play? I've only seen him on TV. Of course, he's dead now. But it's just incredible. He makes it look so easy. I feel I could get the... And it's like he's making no effort, and it almost seems like he doesn't move his fingers, and yet every note is struck and struck perfectly. It's just amazing. This man is like inseparable from the piano. The piano, the keys of the piano are like extensions of his fingers. It's right there with it. There's no separation of Horowitz and the music and the piano. So I think in that moment he has forgotten himself. This little ego self. Afterward, I'm sure he likes to bask in the praise and everything that comes with it. And he was very rough on his students. In fact, it was probably a big mistake to go play with Horowitz, even if you're good enough to become a student of his, because he was notoriously hard on his students. But this is what he had to say. He said, young artists today listen to records and want to play like the artist. They don't try to play like themselves. I never listened to my own records. I don't play the way I did 10 years ago, so why should I? Sometimes on the radio, I'll recognize my playing. Sometimes I'm wrong. The only pianists I listen to are of the old generation, Rachmaninoff especially. He didn't sound like anyone else, only like himself. I don't take students who come in and want to imitate me. The teacher should be a conductor. A conductor doesn't take a flute or a clarinet and show someone how to play it. He tells them what they have to do, and they have to find out how. But everybody wants the easy way. It's much easier than the hard way. I love everything which is difficult, he says. Now that's Vladimir Horowitz. But the conductor doesn't take the flute or the clarinet and show them how to play it. Only they can play the flute or the clarinet. He just tells them what they have to do. And they have to find out how. So this would be the role of the teacher. Is, you know, we expect the teacher or someone else to just kind of lay it on us, you know, like, whoa, now we get something from them. We get some kind of understanding, we get some kind of reward, we get some kind of identification, some kind of certification, some kind of, I don't know, badge or honor or recognition or something. But something is given to us by another out there. But anything that comes to you like that is not you. It is not this true self. It is something that has come across this boundary that's been attached to this little self. Not the true self that is extended into the world. Like Dogen, you know, when he said, to study the way is to study the self, to study the self is to forget the self. And then he said, about this matter of forgetting the self, he said, it's for all things to come forward and confirm the self. Confirm just that, not you again, once again, this little self. It's all things. Some individual thing, teacher gave you this, whatever, and you get some badge, whatever. That's defining this little self. But for all things, the whole universe, right here, coming forward, this confirms the self. But that's not you. That's not just some little ego here. This is the life of the world itself. And if we understand it, if we forget our little self, then we are extended. Just as Horowitz, right, through his fingers, beyond the keys, the piano, where's that? Of course, we can always, intellectually, we can always separate it out. Well, that's Horowitz, of course. There's his finger, and here's the key. Well, it's a dead world. For that kind of life and the music to come out of this is to realize that it is not in such separation. This is the true self that is there, always there, waiting for us to wake up to it. But we're always focused on our little self, on me and what I can get out of this and what can I get from the teacher and all the rest of that. And we don't notice what the real teaching is or what it is that's being pointed out to us. I'm sitting here and I'm talking, you're listening. Ostensibly, I'm a teacher. We say that. Okay, so the teacher's talking and the student's listening. That seems pretty ordinary. But what it is about this way of awakening, is not about what you're going to ultimately get. Well, you don't ultimately get anything from just that. It's just, I say something and you get an idea. It has to be something digested and realized. You know, a Dharma teaching is such that when something is pointed out and said, you realize that in yourself. As Horowitz said, the conductor just points something out to you. You have to find it yourself. They just tell you what to do, what this is, walk this way, sit down, whatever. But you have to find it. You have to realize how. That cannot be taught or handed to you. That does not come across a boundary. And to the extent that we hold ourselves within this confines of this little ego self, we never wake up to that. We don't realize that. We don't understand that. My own teacher, Katagiri Roshi, he used this image from time to time, and I've mentioned it here before, likening the teacher, the role of the teacher, to the antique dealer. Some of you know that story. Yeah, the antique dealer, it's a master antique dealer. And antique dealer has an apprentice. So he's sort of like the teacher to the apprentice. So how does the antique dealer teach the apprentice? Telling him this piece comes from this dynasty and it's this, you know. Well, sure, that maybe has its place, its value. But in this story, what the antique dealer does, and according to Katagiri, was sort of like, this actually goes on, this is how an antique dealer would train a student. You have a plain open room, kind of like this room would be if we all left. It's pretty bare, just an open room, nothing in it. And the antique dealer would bring in a masterpiece, put it there in the middle of the room, and then let the student go in, view the masterpiece. Walk around it and look at it. Man, antique dealer doesn't say anything. maybe not even there. He's going. Next day, another object, another masterpiece sitting there in that room. And the master lets the student in. Go in and view that piece in there. Doesn't say anything. Well, then this just goes on day after day after day after day for years. Every day, the master just shows a masterpiece. And finally, one day, the antique dealer, master antique dealer, he puts in a fake. And then the student walks into the room and immediately student can see the fake. It is something like this. What did this student learn during this time? Was it some specific thing that was told to you? Something that you should know, something you should pick up, something that you need to get hold of to form your identity? You know, I understand, I know these kinds of pieces. Or is it something else? Say maybe internal, but that's when we think that we have an inside and an outside, you know, there's something that we've internalized. But then that's, if we think of it in those terms, again, it's still kind of subjectifying it and objectifying it. If we want to awaken to reality, we have to awaken to the fact that these are not clear boundaries. And that this true self, it is boundless, it is just here. And you have to find your way. I have to find my way. The teacher cannot take you by the hand and bring you something, because that will always be something told to you. Something imposed from the outside. It's like the student who comes in to see Yun Men and he's just reciting somebody else's verse. Just kind of reads a lot, you know, so you understand that, you know, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't read this material. You should. I've read this. I still read it. It's just like with the antique dealer. We come in and we see this over and over and over again. But without taking, nothing is spoken, nothing is taking hold of here. We just keep looking at it and looking at it until at some point we begin to realize what it is. And what really brings that into sharp contrast is when suddenly you see something that is fake, not genuine. All of a sudden, it really stands out. So now you can see. What is it we're talking about? What do you see? That's what's called reality. Just seeing directly what is actually taking place here. How else do you expect to learn this? Because every little piece that's dragged over here and say, you know, it's this or it's that, you know, recite this poem, this verse, you commit this to memory, whatever else, you copy the teacher and this sort of thing. That isn't the point. You know, Norm and I, we were blessed with the fact that we had a teacher who was of a different culture. You know, a different native, he was Japanese, and so he... there's no way we could speak the way he spoke without really looking very foolish. And so that was a blessing. Nevertheless, there were times when people would kind of copy him in various ways, not necessarily the way he spoke, but in various ways. Like Vladimir Horowitz, he says he doesn't want a student that will just copy him, just mimic him. He'll show you something. He's showing you something. You absorb, like the apprentice coming in and looking at a masterpiece here. Horowitz shows you something, but you have to find out how. Because that part can't be taught to you. That is coming out of you. But that is found in this true self. When this boundary that has cut you off and divided you and separated you from all of that is forgotten, as Dogen says, then it is there. Then we awaken to it. Then we see it. What have you gotten? Well, you haven't really gotten hold of anything. This is why the master or enlightenment cannot be handed to you. Just as simple as that. Because anything that does end up getting handed to you, oh, okay, now I got it. But yes, but that's just another thing. Like all the rest. Ultimately, it is illusory. It has the appearance of substantiality, but it has none. You hang on to that, and that forms and solidifies this illusory thing here called me, the self. And we live in this delusional way. Now everything is... sometimes things seem to liven up a bit, but it's pretty dead. It's not real life, not true living. This comes with, as Socrates said, careful examination of this actual life right here. What we need to be looking for is how we keep making something out of it. This is why it says in the Sandokai, just to drag in one more teacher here, Shinto, but he says in the Sandokai, you know, the merging of difference and unity. I'm going on about Shinto and I forget, what did Shinto say? another line from a different piece just suddenly popped into my head. What did Shinto say? Yeah. Yeah, the whole thing. I'm sorry. See, I should write my talks down, then I'd have it.
In accordance with nothing, it's still not interesting.
No. Well, anyway. Oh, yes. No. That's the line that I kept thinking of, and that's from the That's from the Song of Jumir Awareness. I finally got it. And I think you just knocked it out of my head again. He says, don't make up standards on your own. Yeah. So this is also important then, you see. Don't make up standards on your own. Don't imitate. That's like one extreme. Going to one extreme and you're imitating something. But also we will tend to run off and make up standards on it. Because what is that? That standard of... Well, that's just some kind of formula that you've processed, you've identified with now. Well, I do it this way. This is my way of doing it. Yeah. Well, how about just not having any particular way? But let the occasion, the time, the circumstances allow this to be what it is. It's like a master chef. Suddenly you don't have this ingredient, but you can use something else, you know? Of course, if it's a master, they know what they can do and what they can get away with and what works and that sort of thing. But this comes with actually, you know, letting it go. But if we will continue to hold to our way or to something that we've been handed or something we're imitating, some kind of pattern like that, and it is dead. So the role of the teacher, like the antique dealer, is to come in, show you something, you see that, you observe that, okay. But don't get hold of it. Don't try to imitate it. Just realize what that is. Yourself. You find out how and what. This has to be found directly with this kind of a dropping away. Dogen speaks of dropping away of body and mind, dropping away of this identity of selfhood. Then we can realize what has all along been pointed out to you here. It is not about getting an idea. It's not about getting any kind of reward or certificate or acknowledgement or anything else in the end. It is about learning to be here, to be awake, and to realize just what this is. Well, maybe I said enough here this morning, so I'll stop. But maybe you have a question? Yes?
Talking about teacher-student relationship, with that situation where the medical student and a teacher and this knowledge that they need to know.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a little story. Years ago, I was first teaching some classes, and this fellow, that I knew him actually from elsewhere, but he was coming, and he was a physician. A doctor, and we were probably discussing, I don't know, one of the classes anyway, something probably triggered this conversation. But anyway, he said he noticed that in medical school, you had certain professors, you know, that would tell you, this is what you need to know, you learn this and learn this and learn this, and you know, and this will be on the test and all that kind of stuff, and you have it all kind of nailed down. These are the procedures for such and such, you know. He said they liked those professors. It was very clear. But then there were these other, you know, occasionally they'd have one would say, well, you know, this is a kind of a subtle thing here. They can't really quite pin it down. And some people think it might be like this, and others feel like there's something to this over here, this other way. And those kinds of professors, they didn't like them because they wanted to know. They, come on, what is it? What's the answer? I want to know. I can memorize this. I can, you know. But then he said later, after he, you know, graduated, got his MD and started practicing, and as he was getting older now, he said, you know, I realized that what he got from these profs that didn't quite pin things down was a greater sense of the realities that he would be facing. There was something just truer about it. And the kind of information he got, well, it's like this, and it's this, and you do that, that wasn't quite as useful. Wasn't quite as helpful, he said. I mean, that's just a story. But it doesn't mean that we're doing something vague, however. Because actually, what we can discover, maybe not so much in medicine, though I suspect this could be true in any endeavor that we take up. But what we discover, by not getting hold of this or that, it seems like we're entering into territory of vagueness. Now, we don't quite understand what's going on there, but what comes out of that is an absolute clearness about reality. There's no mystery to this. It is quite clear what is real and true and genuine. And to the extent that we keep pinning it down, it is this, it is this, it is this, we end up in the paradox and contradiction and confusion, where we never have a sense that we ultimately understand what's going on here. This is what we will find if we investigate it, very carefully in these ways. And I've looked at it again and again. And this is invariably where we go with this. And yet, this way will always feel comfortable to us. The way of where things are sharply defined and definite, that feels comfortable. Until we get it, like the medical doctor said, until I've been practicing for a while and I realize this isn't, you know, it's only has a limited use. Learning something else out of this that's really teaching me something about how to treat patients. Well, what exactly would they do? I can't even really say. Never could really quite pin that down. But out of that is coming a deeper understanding of the reality that we are living with here. We have a very strong tendency to go that way, to the particular, to the graspable, to the, you know, the formulated and all of that. And there's a place for it. Again, as I've also said before, when we talk, it sounds dualistic and it sounds like, that's bad and this is good. No, there's a place for that, but we forget all about this. And we have a tendency not to go there because it seems so vague. But were we to just step into that, learning to watch your mind. Because you'll step into that, but then you'll start grasping things. You'll start playing the game that belongs over here. Because you formulate things out of the vagueness, and you'll solidify that because you're always reaching for clear. You're trying to find it, and the mind will start putting it there. That's making up standards on your own. Learn to recognize when you're doing that, and don't do that. Set it down. Let it go. But continue to look in this way. It doesn't mean to abandon all of that, the technical kind of stuff, the specific and the definite. No, we need this. Very functional and useful, but it is also limited. What is necessary is to have the depth of knowledge, and which is direct knowledge, direct experience and realization of reality, that gets missed, utterly missed. You can't get there from here. We have to venture into this other place. So in the case of, yes, say medicine, well, I think maybe we need a little bit of both. But unfortunately, this other way is not easily, again, as I said, you can't even really teach it. But that's what our practice is here. That's our endeavor. We look at that. We take the, you know, we bring this up. There's also a place for that, the technical, whatever. We learn a little bit of that. But our practice, our way, is to go into this place where we can't get hold of anything. But what will come out of that is a profound realization, ultimately, of what's going on here. Which, if all we ever did was go into the particular, we would never even have an inkling of it. It would always seem kind of, you know, this life that we're living here just seems surrounded like by this great mystery. Well, there's really nothing mystery. It's only mystery because we we keep playing the game of trying to grab hold of it. It's this or it's that, or well, how does that work? And it never goes into that. So it always leaves us feeling mystery. We go over into this other way, but we'll start forming things and we grab them. We still think we're playing with mystery. If you just let go of that, just stop. Just keep going. Recognize when you're telling yourself, you're making up a story here. Just keep your eyes open. You'll start to see finally where we are and what this is. That is our way. That's what our practice is. That's why, like Suzuki Roshi will say something like, when my talk is over, your listening is over. There's no need to remember what I said. When we're over here, that doesn't make any sense. What do you mean? Well, then what's the point of saying anything? Well, it's because we're pointing to something else here that you can't get your hand on. But we need to have our attention drawn in that way from time to time. That's what this practice is. Do you ever notice, like, so oftentimes we come out of talks? I remember I used to experience this a lot with my teacher. You give a talk and say, wow, great talk. You walk out and then somebody asks you, what was it? I don't know. Over and over again, And I've heard people say that here too. And of course, it's true, because when we're working with this kind of stuff, it is just like that. But never mind. Just stay with it. Stay with it. Stay with it. Enlightenment comes up from behind. It isn't something you go after. That's just a particular thing you're reaching for and trying to grasp. We just stay with this, stay with this. At some point, suddenly it's enlightenment. But it is not something that we ever get a hold of. Never. Even after you're lost in it. Or maybe a better way to just say that we awaken. But it's lost, forgotten, dropped. Self dropped. With enlightenment, that has to go. It just has to go. But again, always grasp to reach, it's this or it's that. That keeps forming the self over and over and over again. And we're very used to that way. And we're very comfortable with it. Then we wonder, why is the backdrop of my life so uncomfortable? And so don't understand what this is. How did we get here? What's going on? What is human life? Well, it's because we keep doing that. And that has a place. It has a place. It's very functional, very useful, very helpful. We can't live without it. I want to really stress that because people think I'm somehow poo-pooing that, and I'm not. Necessary. But that isn't all there is. There is this other way. And when we go this other way, you watch it now because you're going to start putting things there. You're going to start forming things because that's the game we play. That's what we're used to, and that makes us feel more comfortable when I can get hold of something. We feel very uncomfortable to keep stepping, off that 100-foot pole. Stepping off into the void or whatever. That's what it might feel like at times. Just never mind that and just come back to this and take care of all of these issues over here, the practical everyday ones. You can't drop that. But don't look for the ultimate there. Well, don't look for the ultimate here either. Just stop. Stop looking. Stop searching. Those who are awake, they don't search. They're not looking for something. To be looking for something is, once again, you've got some assumption that you've boxed something up there, now you're trying to find it out there in the void. It's wrong. Wrong understanding. What I mean by going in this direction is just, as Robert Thurman in some book anyway, he uses this term that the bodhisattva develops this tolerance for inconceivability. Yeah, we develop a tolerance. Of course, even that's too harsh, because it isn't that we tolerate. I learned to tolerate inconceivable, but it is kind of like that at first, because we don't tolerate it. We want something secure, something to grab hold of. So it seems like when we go into this direction, can't get hold of anything, and now it seems it's very insecure. It's inconceivable, and our mind begins to say, that's all coming because you're still trying to get hold of something. Recognize what you're doing and stop doing that if you can. At some point, you might finally recognize what you're doing, because it's only through recognizing what you're doing finally that you can realize, just let go, just trust that, let go. That's the trusting of the heart and mind that we find in the Xin Jing Ming. Trust it. Trust the actual experience here. And lo and behold, actual understanding comes with that, not with this. This leaves us feeling mystery. This clears it up, so to speak. Well, maybe I've said enough on that point. Yeah.
It seems to me that the examined life is the dismantled self. Now, had Socrates succeeded in dismantling the self, he could have left his robes at the city gate and left instead of drinking hemlock or doing like a monk, self-immolating himself for some idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe so. You know, he might have seen that there was really no need for him. Though he makes a very good argument in Plato's account, the Apology there. He makes a very good argument for why to drink the hemlock. Though I'm not going to get into that now. Yes? Sure.
Is not the dismantled self enlightened?
Well, I wouldn't put it that way, because there's a presumption that there is such a thing in the first place that could be dismantled. And with the actual awakening, that whole construct is, it's like fantasy from the very start.
This body itself is self-dismantled.
Well, you could say that. I mean, that's how it appears. But with awakening, there's no such thing. There's nothing corresponding to this body. This anything is no particular thing. That is what is finally seen. And with seeing that, everything else is quite clear. Nevertheless, we still have the everyday and the practical. We can't throw that away. But we're seeing it now in a radically different way. But there is really nothing there to disintegrate, you know, such as the self. You know, it isn't like with awakening, somehow our ego self-destruct or something like that. It's just kind of seen through. It's like waking up to the boogeyman in the closet and you realize, well, there is no such thing. So finally, now you have the courage to open the door, and sure enough, there isn't. And it's like saying, but where did the boogeyman go then? You know, did it just self-destruct or something? And so that's still hanging on to a thought of self, as if there were something in the first place that could have fallen apart or disappeared or gone into the walls or whatever, you know. And of course, but that thought is, well, it could reconstruct again too, couldn't it? You know, so because we still haven't left the world of the particulars yet, you know. Or listen, it's not that we ever really do, but we don't see through it. We haven't really seen through that yet, that illusion. But with the seeing through of it, yeah, nothing is really. That's why you really don't have to. Of course, to practice this way and to step into these places that I've suggested here, it's just a metaphor. Don't hang on to it too tightly. But in doing that, we become kind of nervous at times. Because as this ego, this sense of self, we become kind of fearful. Like we're afraid it's going to disintegrate or fall apart or something like that, of course. But that's just, once again, there because we've put it together in the wrong way in the first place. Well, the fact is we've put something together at all. And that's why things start to rattle. But, you know, it's like when you're still not too sure about, I don't think there's a boogeyman in there, but we're still a little nervous. You know, our hand is trembling, we open the door, and, you know, that sort of thing is what's happening. With actual seeing, that's all gone. It's just gone. And that's usually powerful enough so that we don't remain too deceived for too long. Though we do. We repeatedly fall back into old ways. Then our practice becomes just learning to walk this without continuously slipping back into it, which is endless. Endless. There's no endless refinement. Well, I probably should stop unless there's another burning question. No. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.